Appreciate your being here this morning, and we want to try to start on time or relatively on time if we can, and we appreciate members being here and members of the public. This morning we are going to hear a presentation from Dr. Doug Wood from the Mayo Clinic, who has, I think, some interesting ideas for us as we look at not only addressing our budget issues, but also the bigger challenge of how we can bring about some change and reform to healthcare in the state primarily, but perhaps across the country as well. And so we are glad to have you with us this morning, Doctor. We appreciate your taking time to come up from Rochester. Hope the weather wasn't too much of an impediment, but glad you're here and look forward to your presentation. So if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself for the record, and then I'll turn it over to you.
Certainly, Chairman Hand. My name is Douglas Wood. I'm a cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And in my work, besides taking care of patients, I am chair of the Division of Healthcare Policy and Research at Mayo, and I also am the medical director of the Quality Academy at Mayo. The Quality Academy is the part of our organization that tries to teach all kinds of principles of quality design and improvement across the organization, going from Minnesota to Arizona, Florida, and everywhere in between. So those are my jobs at Mayo. I'm privileged to be here today. I appreciate the invitation, and I hope that the discussion today will be helpful to you as you begin to move forward with some rather substantial issues. In the last day or so, I've been asked fairly frequently, what do we do next, especially after Judge Vinson's decision in Florida.
Can I interrupt you for one minute, Doctor? Just I'd like to encourage you to bring the microphone close. We have a room that has some acoustical issues, and I know Senator Higgins, is not here yet, but she will apparently there are dead spots in the room, so if you can
I hope this is then
much better.
Quite an improvement. At any rate, from my perspective, really, not much has changed, and I want to emphasize this from the perspective of the point of view of the Mayo Clinic Health Policy Center, an activity that was chartered back in 2006. The fundamental problem for us is that our healthcare spending continues to grow faster than the economy. Even before the recession occurred, this was the case. And a large point from Mayo's perspective is that we are not getting value for the money we are spending. In particular, if you look at this at a large level, at the national level, the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission published a report earlier this year that suggests that probably about 30% of utilization and maybe a larger amount of spending is in fact unnecessary and thus wasteful. We could certainly use those resources for other things. It's also clear to us that payment reform alone will not solve our problems. We will need delivery system reform in order to make some very substantial improvements in how we deliver care. But delivery system reform will not be sufficient either. And I think it's also appropriate to consider that if we don't solve this problem of healthcare costs, then it really will threaten the economic health of our society and our communities. Now, what does this mean for Minnesota? I think it's important for us to think about this in the context of families and of small businesses and of large businesses and of the state. In particular, in Minnesota, the cost of family coverage have more than doubled since 2006. They're now about $11,000 a year. And it's clear to families who are struggling to maintain insurance that if they have insurance, they're paying more. They have a higher deductible, they're paying more out of pocket. So if they can maintain coverage, it's costing them more and they're getting less. Insurance offerings from employers are also fewer. So some employers are dropping coverage altogether, and some are, in fact, offering fewer options that might be, in fact, more costly. If we start to think about Minnesota spending in particular, healthcare spending in Minnesota is lower than the national average, and it is a smaller part of our gross domestic product than most other states in the country, but, and in big capital letters, but, healthcare spending in this state continues to grow faster than the rate of the economy, and the Minnesota Department of Health Economic Program projects spending will continue to grow at a fairly substantial rate. And our public spending over the last several years has grown at a rate faster than private spending. So the problem, in essence, is unchecked. Here's a graphic representation of spending in Minnesota by payment source. This information does come from the Minnesota Department of Health Economics Program. There are some of us who tend to think that certain parts of the society consume more resources than others. In particular, I commonly hear around Mayo an assumption that those Minnesotans who are covered by GAMC consume more on an average basis than those Minnesotans in Medicaid. But this graph simply shows us that there are variations. There are reasons for these variations. But again, the fundamental problem that goes across all of these is that we have to find a way that we can improve how we deliver care to make it more effective and more efficient and be able to reduce the spending across the board. So the spending, I think, can, in fact, be reduced without adversely affecting the quality of care. And in the rest of the presentation, I hope I can demonstrate that. Now, we also tend to think about things as a one-size-fits-all, especially when we use figures that describe averages. The point of this slide is to be careful about making too many assumptions about averages. So I just showed you that the medical assistance costs are among the highest per person. But when you consider the distribution of those people that are in this program, the disabled and the blind consume a fair amount of resources, even though they are a much smaller proportion of the total enrollees. So a strategy that might be employed to try to reduce spending across the board without considering where there are opportunities might also fail to yield the results that we would like and may also be then detrimental to the health and welfare of the people that are in this segment of the program. So that adds to the complexity of what it is we're trying to do. We can, I think, say about public spending in Minnesota that our increases are driven by a variety of factors. Enrollment grows up, especially as the economy declines. The loss of insurance for many of these individuals is fairly substantial. They will then postpone care for things that could, in fact, be cared for in an office. It ends up being then a hospital emergency room visit. I can pretty well tell you that if you end up in a hospital emergency room, you are likely to end up in the hospital at least for a period of observation care, if not for an inpatient stay. And that becomes an immediate opportunity. We have in this state worked hard to control our long care costs, but the population is aging. The number of people over 85 is increasing faster than any other population segment. So this still is also a significant opportunity for us in terms of looking at improvements in delivery and efficiency. And as I mentioned at the outset, the best opportunity for savings is going to be from a combined delivery and payment reform approach. One or the other alone is not going to get us where we need to be. So what have we tried in the past? In the United States, we've tried price controls, and the preeminent price control approach has been used in the Medicare program. We try to do that in the Medicaid program across the country as well, and some commercial plans have tried to do it. We've begun to look at bundled payments. Some of you are familiar with the DRG program for bundled payments for inpatient care in the Medicare program that's been around since the 1980s, and it's worked pretty well. In the Minnesota reform of 2008, we've tried, in fact, to adopt this concept and move it into other kinds of payment for medical services in Minnesota. This was one of the cornerstones of the reform that was passed in 2008 and signed by the governor. The uptake so far has been somewhat slow. There are some reasons for that, but it is not because the method doesn't work, and I'll show you where the opportunities are for something like this in a few minutes. In some circumstances, restrictive networks are developed. The commercial plans are probably the best at this, and restrictive networks do not always achieve the results that you want. In particular, when you have persons who have fairly complex conditions, for example, like pancreatic cancer or maybe complex neurologic diseases, it is probably best that you try to find the best quality provider in the state and treat that as an in-network provider rather than try to treat it as an out-of-network provider and create barriers to access for patients. Overall cost probably would be lower by taking that kind of an approach rather than trying to use a restrictive approach. Now, I want to show you some results from the Medicare program that show us, in fact, why price controls don't work. And to start with this, we have to understand the concept of total cost of care, and we'll come back to this. In the 2007 timeframe, when the Governor's Transformation Task Force and the Legislative Access Commission were working on drafting the proposals that would go forward for health reform in Minnesota, the concept of total cost of care was actually incorporated in those discussions, and it ended up in the Senate file that moved forward in 2008, but it ultimately was not part of the final package. But the total cost of care represents the unit price times the total use. And the leverage here is more in the total use. And I will try to illustrate why the leverage is more in the total use as we go along. It'll be, I think, easier to understand from those examples rather than try to look at it with large-scale economic perspectives. What this graph shows is the annual rate of increase in physician fee and then the expenditures per fee-for-service beneficiary in the Medicare program. In the years 1997 to 2001, physician fees, which are in the orange, grew each year at a rate of about 3%. And the total cost of care in the Medicare program rose a little over 7% each year. You might remember that in 1997, in a budget reduction act, the sustainable growth rate was actually adopted to try to constrain the rate of growth in spending. And the sustainable growth rate has been a source of great irritation for the American Medical Association in particular, but physicians in general, because what it tries to do is to constrain unit pricing. So in 2001, for the very first time using this formula, we reduced the fee or the unit price. But that did not reduce total spending. And the reason was because physicians and other providers found a way to overcome the reduction in unit price by simply increasing volume or increasing the amount of things that were done. So the use rate is truly the part of the equation for which there is the greatest leverage. Now, if we think about this in a different format, there has been a lot of debate about the ACA, that is the Affordable Care Act, the law of the land at this point. It says that there are significant government intrusions in health care, and there are discussions about rationing. But we should realize that our resources are finite. We have already some strong efforts underway in Minnesota that we started in 2008. We didn't do all of the things that we thought we might want to do, and there are a couple of things that are left that may be very good opportunities for us in this session and perhaps in the next. We have to do more work that will encourage providers to create value and affordable care, not simply produce tests and office visits and things of that sort. So when we talk about value, that's what we mean. We mean paying for results, not paying for simply having something done. And the second point that's one that we're making strongly from Mayo Clinic's Health Policy Center is that we have to find ways that we can make it easier for everyone to have affordable insurance. In that circumstance, I go back to having had the privilege of working on several groups in the 2007 timeframe that led to the 2008 reform. There was a strong sense among the legislative leaders at the time, including some in the room, Senator Berglund and some others, Representative Huntley, who emphasized that affordability for everyone is a significant issue. It is more than simply providing access. And this is where I think Minnesota for years has been substantially farther ahead than states like Massachusetts, who those states have concentrated largely on access. We have concentrated more on affordability. So when we think about what we want, I also want to let you know that there is more to this than just health care. So this slide actually reviews what are called the determinants of health. And the health outcomes of length of life and freedom from disease or impairment of disease are at the top of this graph. And when we think about the role of the physical environment, social and economic factors, clinical care or the healthcare system, and health behaviors, the healthcare system itself, in terms of its clinical care, what I do every day in the office or what I do in the hospital, really affects only about 20% of the outcome. So the other important challenge for us, and especially for you as legislative leaders, is that as we think about the kinds of things we need to do, decisions that we might make about education, about the environment, and about tax policy that might influence how some of us decide that we're going to do certain things, like use cigarettes or other things, could have some very beneficial impacts. And so I would urge you not to ignore the fact that this is actually a larger solution than simply trying to find a narrow solution in terms of what we are going to pay for medical care services. We actually are using this in the Mayo Health System in Austin, Minnesota, to try to create an entirely different approach to health care that emphasizes the economic vitality of the community. And in that circumstance, the components for us are a better education, achieving a healthier workforce, lowering health care costs, and finding a way that we can, in fact, sustain job creation. And health care is at the middle of that because it's a big piece, and it's an expensive piece, and if it's used wisely and leveraged well, it can be, in fact, a productive piece. So what have we done so far? Just to remind you, in Minnesota, the State Health Improvement Program was a significant investment in public health. We adopted a medical home payment approach that will now be the model for the land. The approach that we developed in Minnesota will be a payment model that will be used by Medicare in its advanced medical care, it's an advanced medical home or primary care demonstration project. We've done some bets. We've done some baskets of care work. We actually can do more, but we know how we can do episode-based payment. And the provider peer grouping effort is a big piece of this. It's going a little slower than we hoped, but it is going. This will give us actually an essential piece of information that will allow consumers and buyers and policymakers to see what utilization is. When this data set will be extremely rich, we'll be able to look at utilization patterns and understand where we could make some very specific improvements that would actually not only improve health, but would reduce spending as well. There is another considerable opportunity here, and that is that when we start thinking about creating payment reforms that might revolve around projects like an accountable care organization or an ACO, you'll hear a lot about that, the data resources are very important to make those things work. So the provider peer grouping project that we started will be a substantial resource not just for the policymakers, but even for people who are taking care of patients. Because with a resource like that as a physician, I can begin to see where utilization is occurring that is outside my specific control. So there are a number of patients who may seek care in places other than my clinic. If I don't know about those, then I will have very little leeway or very little leverage in trying to understand why that additional utilization occurred and what we could do to improve the health and utilization patterns of our patients. So what are the opportunities? In the Affordable Care Act, the insurance market reforms that provide chances for exchanges provide a substantial opportunity for states to do things the way states want to do them. The risk in the Accountable Care Act is if states do not take advantage of the opportunity, then somebody else, in particular the federal government, will do it for the states. Whether the Affordable Care Act proceeds intact or not, I think in this circumstance, again, is largely irrelevant. If you go back to the 2007 time frame in Minnesota, we were talking about exchanges. And when, in fact, we had an exchange concept in some of the things that we would move forward into the 2008 session. So we, again, were ahead of the United States by quite a number of years in thinking about how we would move forward. It would not be bad at all for us to go back to those circumstances and think about how we could create an exchange that would help provide affordable care and predictability in spending for families, for small businesses, for large businesses, and for the state government. There are in the Affordable Care Act some opportunities that we might be able to take advantage of in terms of demonstration projects. Individual providers will actually do that and would not need state permission to do so. And it would be helpful for us to be able to remember that there are a number of fairly innovative groups in Minnesota who would like to take advantage of these approaches, and we should try not to put barriers in their ways to do that. There are some expansions and subsidies that would be available. We don't know exactly how those are going to go, but even if they did not come to pass, it comes back to the same thing I mentioned earlier. We have to find a way to better manage the cost of care. So what do we need to do to take advantage of these opportunities? First, we need to understand the aims. And in the last several years, the Minnesota Department of Health has tried to express an expectation that we want to achieve the triple aim: improving the health of individuals and the experience of individuals with the delivery system, improving the population health, and reducing costs all at the same time. We have to encourage new delivery systems that will, in fact, create value. and we have to find new insurance markets that will make affordable coverage available to everybody. And those markets will need to have, from our perspective, pretty good consumer protections, especially so that in an exchange, the exchange is not subject to the vagaries of adverse selection. We would not want the plans to find a way to sell outside the exchange and then shift a lot of cost onto those people who are in the exchange, because that will not help them achieve affordable care. So now let's think about some examples. I want to use the example of heart surgery for coronary artery disease, bypass operations. Those are something that are familiar to all of us. And this outlines a method called shared decision making. So in the United States, in looking at a group of people who were contemplating bypass surgery, those patients, when given an opportunity to hear about the relative pros and cons of bypass surgery, chose surgery less often than those people who were not given that opportunity. And that's a 30% reduction in utilization. Now, how do we know this is the right thing to do? There's a large trial that's been done in the United States called the COURAGE trial, and it took people who had coronary artery disease that was severe enough to look like it might need bypass surgery or angioplasty or could be treated with medication. These people were then randomized to either medication or angioplasty or surgery as the initial intervention, and they were followed for 10 years. At the end of 10 years, those people who were treated with medication and not with more expensive angioplasty and not with more expensive surgery did just as well. They had no more heart attacks, they had no more deaths than the people who had angioplasty or surgery. Now, this is not rationing. This is rational thinking. This is rational practice. This is rational decision making. When we then can convert that into practice, I can sit in my office with a patient who has symptoms of angina, and I can explain to them, your prognosis over the next 10 years is going to be the same no matter what I do for you. I can make you feel comfortable with medications, and as long as those medications work, we're fine. If they don't work, then we can start thinking about the prospect of angioplasty or the prospect of surgery. Rather than me saying to them, you need surgery right away or you need angioplasty right away. In fact, if I would tell them you need angioplasty right away, there's a much greater likelihood they're going to need a second angioplasty because of the complication relates to the first angioplasty. There's another example of rational decision making. These are in people who get defibrillators. So defibrillators are devices that are put in to prevent sudden death. There are guidelines for putting these things in. In the United States, there is now evidence that a fourth, 25% of defibrillators that are put in outside of guidelines. Now, the bad thing about that is that if you were a patient who had a defibrillator put in outside of guidelines, you were three times more likely to die than if you had it put in according to the guidelines. So it is more likely that the defibrillator may have contributed to your death than helped prevent it. That's, again, not rationing when we say you should not have a defibrillator because you don't meet the criteria. That's rational decision making. And if you look at this 30% reduction and you just think about healthcare utilization, especially for some big ticket items like this, if we're spending $35 billion a year in the state of Minnesota and you look at the big ticket items, and you could reduce their utilization by 30%, then pretty soon you get some really big dollars adding up. So this has an important lesson that we need to work at this across the board if we're going to achieve affordability across the board. And it's more important that we do it for everyone so that everyone has, again, the best access to care and is more likely to get the best care, and their total costs will decrease. Another approach is with capitation, or mini-capitation, or what you can call episode-based payment, or baskets of care. Now, the example that we often were exposed to in the years of reform in 2008 was heart failure treatment, especially in Duluth. But there are hospitals in the Twin Cities and in rural Minnesota who have done the same thing. The Medicare program tends to force you to get paid only if you have a face-to-face visit. We know we can deliver substantially better care when we don't have a face-to-face doctor visit. So the point of this simply is that if we change the way we pay, we are more likely to get the results we want and have more predictable spending at lower costs as a result. And here's the reason this has such leverage. 1% of the population accounts for about 30% of the cost, and 10% of the population for about 77% of the cost. There's a graph that we actually look at in terms of spending, and for office-based care, you don't spend very much. But if you're in the hospital for heart failure, you can easily spend $10,000 in 2 days. So that's where the leverage happens to be, and that's one of the reasons that in the 2008 reform we tried to move that forward. Now, what about a new insurance market? The opportunities that exist for us, again, coming back to some ideas that we explored in 2007, are to have a single statewide exchange. From my perspective, a public-private entity that offers individually owned insurance and handling all enrollment and eligibility determinations, and maintaining the Minnesota not-for-profit model with requirements that all sales be in the exchange, or at least protections that would keep the exchange from being ravaged by adverse selection, could be a way to go. Now, nationally, there is an exchange of sorts, and that's the Federal Employee Health Benefit Plan for those employees that are in the federal government's plans. There's a basic benefit set, but beyond that, there's substantial choice, and those employees can pick anything they want based on what they consider affordable for themselves. I think there are a number of substantial advantages for this approach. It gives us affordable insurance for families. It gives us predictable costs for businesses. It gives us predictable costs and budgets for state government. And if we can then get the plans in the exchange to focus on maintaining long-term relationships and negotiating with delivery systems to create those kinds of delivery system and payment reforms that would produce better results at lower total costs, we would be much better off. The alternative solutions that we could consider for delivery, we should begin to emphasize to our physicians that we want you to produce health, not health care. Now, when we were doing our research in Austin, Minnesota, health turned out to be an ability to maintain normal day-to-day activities that meant that the people who were depending on you would be okay. That's what health means. And there are a number of different ways that we can do this. The details today are probably not as important as thinking about the big decision of moving forward with a mechanism that, in fact, we can do this. We can spend hours trying to haggle out the details. And again, from my perspective, not important. Now it's important to make the big decision about moving forward with the structure that we want. Our plans now spend lots of money on health education, on utilization management, and other things. Those things are done without a single strategy. We decided in the 2008 reform to spend about $47 million for a statewide health improvement program. If you read the State Department of Health summary of the reports sent to it by the plans are spending similar amounts of money on health education. With a carefully crafted exchange and a strategy about how we're going to use resources, we could use those monies to actually achieve some of the goals we were trying to accomplish with state spending. There are some other ways I think that we can, in fact, achieve better results. I want to leave time for questions. And so in the context of drug therapy, one thing that comes up frequently is that the plans each year tend to change what's covered and not covered. That adds a lot of administrative expense because it means that people have to go to their pharmacy in January and get new prescriptions. The pharmacists have to then do all of that work. They have to send all the prescription requests to the doctors. We have to do it all. And it's a waste. So when we start thinking about things that we can do, the science that drives appropriate drug prescribing is the same whether you're a Blue Cross beneficiary, an Alignment beneficiary, a member of group health, or a Medicare beneficiary. We could simply decide we'll have one way to do it, and we'll simplify the administrative work that everybody has to deal with and avoid the adverse outcome, that is patients not having access to medicines when they need them. So again, to reiterate, there are a number of advantages that I think are in front of us if we simply keep our eye on the future, and that is that we need to achieve affordable insurance for families with predictable costs for businesses and governments. And it doesn't take a lot to think that this would work. If we would reduce spending by as little as $500 per person per year in Minnesota, that generates $2.5 billion of reduced spending on health care. So I've tried to give you a couple of examples of where there might be some even greater leverage. So a bypass operation is easily $60,000. So if I reduce the number of bypass operations by even 10%, that's a substantial leverage point. So with all of those things in mind, that I'm pretty convinced that we actually can create a new approach. It would be based on a new exchange with individually owned insurance, with delivery system and payment reforms that would lead the nation in providing affordable quality care in a way that would ease the burden on every Minnesotan, on every Minnesota business, and ease the burden that we have in state government, and allow us in state government to find the ways that we can provide the resources for adequate subsidies for those people who need help in buying insurance, and finding in a way that makes it possible for them to not be denied access so that they can have access to health care, more than just coverage, have true access. So it means that all of us will have to think about how we're going to do this together. I think that we have tremendous energy and capability. We've made a lot of progress. Minnesota has been a leader. At a meeting that was sponsored by the Minnesota Health Policy Forum a couple of years ago, Mr. Tom Forsyth used an example, and he described a horse race. From his perspective, Minnesota was in a galloping horse around the first turn. Minnesota had a tremendous lead on Massachusetts, who had stumbled coming out of the starting gate. And the federal government was still back in the paddock trying to figure out what saddle to put on the horse. So hopefully we won't stumble, and we'll actually still be in the lead. And I think we can do that. I appreciate the opportunity to come today, and I hope that I can be able to be a resource to you and your colleagues in the future, especially in your deliberations over the next several weeks. And I'd be happy, at the discretion of Chairman Hand, to answer questions or discuss comments you might have.
Thank you, Doctor. We appreciate your presentation. It certainly provides a lot of food for thought, and I assure you we'll take advantage of your offer to continue to work with us as we look for ways to not only solve our short-term budget issues, but also longer-term create, we hope, a more sustainable and better structure for healthcare in the state. I had a couple questions I wanted to ask you more for clarification, but in the early part of your presentation, you were talking about sort of in the current structure, current situation, some conclusions about Minnesota healthcare public program spending, and your point was that public spending increases are driven by increased enrollment, loss of insurance, and then medical cost inflation. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about what you mean by medical cost inflation.
Medical cost inflation actually describes the impact of practice decisions. And in particular, some of the examples that I've used for you about utilization are what drive medical cost inflation. So in medicine, when we decide we want to provide more visits, we want to provide more tests, we want to provide more hospitalizations, especially ones that are not necessary or may which be considered discretionary, that is medical cost inflation. So that's the piece of utilization that is really the leverage to managing total cost of care.
So, Doctor, it sounds like what you're saying is that medical cost inflation is the cost that we absorb somewhere in our overall system to pay for things that are not necessary.
That's correct. All of those costs we have to bear. So to the degree that they're insured, everybody who's participating in an insurance plan is paying for part of those costs.
And Doctor, in your opinion, why would people do things that aren't necessary?
There are a number of reasons, Senator Han, why people may do things that are not considered necessary. In an article published in the Journal of American College of Cardiology a couple of months ago, researchers asked physicians about whether angioplasty would save your life for a blocked coronary artery. And they asked patients what they thought about the same question. Now, doctors know that angioplasty is not going to save your life. In fact, I referenced that in the Courage example that I used. But patients still believe pretty strongly that angioplasty is going to save your life. So to some degree, the driver of that is a combination of patient expectations and, to some degree, physician expectations. In the payment system that we currently use, a cardiologist will get paid more to do the angioplasty than to sit and make the decision that you don't need it. So I, as a cardiologist, am going to be paid less to make the decision that I can treat a person with medications than I would be if I would simply say, you know, we just need to do an angioplasty, let's go do this. I'm going to get paid a lot more for the time that I'm going to spend in that way. Those are a couple of really big drivers. There are some others, but those are a couple of big ones.
Well, Doctor, I appreciate that. That seems reasonable to me as a guy who spent most of my life in business and trying to understand what, you know, how costs work and how decisions get made. Is there an element of this interaction you're describing? In any interaction, in any kind of economic activity, there's always the danger that the vendor or the supplier is going to oversell, if you will, a product or service to a customer. That's always there. There's always that chance. But it seems in most cases there is a break on that because the customer, the person who is paying for the process, weighs the advantage to paying more and what they're getting. They have to come to some judgment, and they may engage in some questioning. They may engage in some research or fact-finding to try to find what is the best value. That doesn't seem to occur in medical practice generally. And could you comment on why that is so?
It doesn't occur, and in fact it could occur, and that was the example of the shared decision-making that I used for you for coronary bypass operations. The reason it doesn't occur, I think, is multifactorial. Again, the way we currently pay physicians is less to spend time deciding to do something and more to actually do it. The lack of information that's available to consumers, so if you're a consumer, it's hard to find the information. Only the most interested and passionate patients and consumers will actually go try to do the research. It's very common for me to see a patient in the office who is sent because they need to have something done, like an angioplasty or a bypass surgery. And then when I listen to their story and look at their circumstances, I can tell them, you do not need that done. They didn't come with that expectation. They came with an expectation that was already put in their mind by another physician that you need to have something done. If we can find a way that we can provide the same basic information for patients and physicians about what the benefits of an intervention will be, I think we'll do better in making some of these decisions. If we then found a way to incorporate into practice and we would pay for shared decision making, I think we would see a reduction in utilization of things like bypass surgery and angioplasty and spine surgery and knee and hip surgery and things like that. So there are ways, again, if you said we're going to start paying differently, we're going to pay you for actually achieving an outcome rather than doing something like a procedure, that would change the practice and the behaviors of both physicians and patients.
Well, and Doctor, as you're describing that, it strikes me that what you're, and maybe I'm, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that what you're describing is that what would be advantageous or what would be directionally positive would be to create conditions in which decision-making about what is to be done as well as the cost or the payment of what is to be done in the hand of the patient so that as they are contemplating the options that they have, they also are contemplating a cost to them personally that would then be perhaps an incentive or encouragement to take the advice of the doctor or to really find out, is, in your example, pharmaceutical treatment or a surgical treatment preferable in my condition. Is that what you're getting at, is that we need to create a structure that has more of that cost control in the hands of individuals so they are absorbing and paying a larger portion of what the costs are?
Absolutely, very simply. I mean, and actually from the perspective of patients, I don't think you even have to worry too much about cost. So if you go back to the example of coronary disease, you can take medications or you can have an angioplasty or you can have a bypass operation. And there are not very many patients who opt for a bypass operation when medications alone are going to work for a while because the bypass operation has more pain and discomfort and a longer period of disability and disruption of their life.
Thank you, Doctor. I'm going to see if there's other questions. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And thank you for coming, Dr. Woods, today to talk to us. I'm wondering if you can help us think about things that we might do to encourage more physicians to join the medical home movement. You know, I think we have about 100 now that have been certified by the State Department of Health. Clearly, that's not even a majority of the physicians in our state. And I'm one of these people who doesn't think that we have the luxury of 10 years to make this change. So I'm wondering if you can help us think about what we could do to encourage more physicians to become part of the medical home movement faster.
Dr. Wood.
Chairman Hannon, Senator Berglund, there are several things I think we can do. The process of certification has been a barrier to some physicians, but the Department of Health, I think, has worked to try to make it relatively easy to do. For a number of physicians, the problem simply is, as they look at the economics, there may not be the gain for them to go through all of this effort. In particular, commercial insurers have not taken up the concept of coordination of care payments as much as has been done, for example, in our state programs. And so in this circumstance, again, I think there may be the opportunity in exchange to really encourage the commercial insurance plans to adopt payment for coordination of care and then make it more attractive to physicians. One advantage that will be coming is that since Minnesota will be a participant in Medicare's Advanced Primary Care Demonstration Project, those physicians who already are certified will actually now be able to receive additional payments from Medicare. So I think those are some of the most important things that we need to do to try to make it more attractive for primary care physicians in particular to go through the process of achieving the certification that's part of this. And then the next thing is to make sure that when we do the recertification, we don't make that more difficult. There's a certain amount of work we have to do to make sure we're achieving the goals, but we don't need to make it excessive.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Woods, the intention was that all commercial insurance would pay a medical home payment to any physician that was certified by the state. Does the law need to be made clearer on that, or is it a matter of enforcing the law?
Dr. Wood.
Chairman Hand, Senator Berglund, I think the law was clear. It would be, I think, helpful to hear the perspective of the plans and the insurers. One of the concerns that I have heard is that some insurers believe we're going to be paying for the service twice. Their expectation is that physicians should provide coordination of care as part of their everyday practice. It doesn't quite work that way, and it's a complex circumstance, but I think the law is clear, and again, I think depending on how we decide to manage the marketplace, perhaps there are ways we could create more of an incentive, or more of a reason for the commercial plans to pick this up. Ultimately, we do have to be able to demonstrate to everybody in the state, to the plans, to the state, to the payers, to the businesses, to the individuals, that in fact we're delivering better value for this coordination of care. I mean, we have to demonstrate that. If we don't, then we probably should look for something different.
Mr. Chairman, just one follow-up, if you don't mind. It does not surprise me that there has been some resistance from the plans, because this is money that they were getting paid before we did the medical home to do care coordination. And I think everybody who voted for the law and everybody who supported it in the community and those of us that worked on the ideas before that believed we could get more value for that money if that was moved from a plan level where they might hire somebody in Tucson to call me up once in a while to the actual primary care physician's office and the team that they would work with. But it is true that when we passed the medical home legislation, it was a financial change of transaction from the health plans to the physician. And so, you know, that might be where the resistance is coming from. But we all have to change to get better value for our dollar. It isn't just the providers, it's also the insurers.
Dr. Wood?
I agree.
Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair and members, maybe last week we got the Council on State Governments magazine that goes to all legislators, and in there there's good information about health insurance, the exchanges. And then I see that we also received an email from CSG in their health reform and state policy news today that that talks about what other states are doing, gives some sample exchange language, and some good information that we probably should all see. And I'm on the CSG health committee, and so I don't know whether this just comes to me because I'm on that. But if it's not in your email today, let me know and I can forward this to anybody that would be interested in it. It's good information.
Thank you, Senator Higgins. I anticipate that we'll have some discussion about exchanges, and if you've got or other members have got information or legislation that they're contemplating, I think we need to get it all on the table and take a look at it. So appreciate that. Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Wood, just briefly talked about the SHIP program that was in the 08 reform dealing with obesity and smoking. And I feel very strongly about prevention, and all 87 counties are participating in the program. And perhaps you can't answer this, but I am looking for results, kind of outcome-based or pay-for-performance kind of results from this program so we can seriously consider moving forward and supporting prevention, which is all part of healthcare reform. And I think actually it's lacking quite a bit on the federal side, but on the state side, our commitment to prevention was stellar. But we need to make sure that these programs, they're addressing outcome and they're addressing the best bang for the dollar. Can you make reference to that?
Dr. Wood.
Certainly, Chairman Hammond, Senator Rosen. The goal of being able to pay for outcomes and results is, in fact, the most important direction that we can take. In prevention, it's important to recognize that there are different levels of prevention, ranging from primary to, depending on which school you're from, tertiary or quaternary. In primary prevention, what we're talking about are things that we might do before there is any evidence of any disease present. In secondary or tertiary prevention, what we're talking about is prevention when a disease is present. For example, if I'm a person who has coronary disease, I should not smoke. That's called secondary prevention. Now, if I'm just coming and I don't have any disease and the doctor tells me you shouldn't smoke, that's primary prevention. It's a little difficult to make a strong business case for primary prevention if you try to do it on a dollars and cents basis, because it takes so long for you to see the outcome. But for secondary prevention, you can see the outcome fairly quickly, sometimes within a year. The important part of prevention here, it goes back to the slide I showed you in terms of the determinants of health. We need to make sure that we recognize that there are lots of decisions that we might make in other areas that would not help us get to our goals. If we make it easier, if you look at the measures of the determinants of health that are used by the Robert Wood Johnson Healthy Community Project, and those measures, by the way, are available on the web, but they look at things like, what is the availability of fresh fruit in a community? What is the density of liquor stores? Are there opportunities for exercise? All of those factors are also important. So when we start thinking about them, there is a benefit, particularly for people with chronic disease, and that's probably where the benefit is the greatest. But we can't minimize the importance of putting all of these things together in a comprehensive solution.
Other question, Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of an offshoot of the question that the chairman had. Not that long ago, I spent a week in a children's hospital with my very young daughter. And I won't bore you with the details of the specifics, but we were in there. And in hindsight, looking back and kind of reading between the lines and seeing what was going on, it seemed that I was involved in an interplay of two dynamics, one of which was what you talked about, Senator Hand, where we are kind of disengaged as consumers. But what also seemed to be doctors either feeling the need or whatever to essentially what seemed to me practicing defensive medicine. I went in with my daughter, and it didn't take too long, and pretty much they said, here's what's going on. We know what the problem is. This should be resolved pretty quickly. But we're going to run all these tests, and we're going to do all these procedures. And I had no incentive. You know, at the time, you just, okay, yeah, you're the doctor. Go ahead, do it. But I had no incentive to ask, what are the odds? I mean, they were testing for extremely rare types of juvenile cancer, brain cancers. And looking back, almost from the get-go, they were telling me, here's what the problem is, and here's the time frame. It should get better. But we're going to do this. We're going to do a CT scan. Oh, and because she's so young, we have to fully sedate her. So it seemed like there was an interplay there of those two dynamics that, as best I can tell, maybe cost $10,000 or $15,000 for procedures and tests that some of which, in hindsight, didn't really seem necessary. Is my case unique, or can you speak to that?
Dr. Wood.
Chairman Hand, Senator Nino, no, your case is not unique. I can give you very similar experiences from my own perspective as a father with two children with very complex diseases, even in the institution in which I work. There is an amazing amount of habit in the practice of medicine and an amazing amount of expectations. And it isn't always driven by evidence. Those are things that we need to become very aggressive at helping physicians make better decisions and helping consumers feel comfortable in asking questions about that sort of thing. So in my own example, a daughter who had Guillain-Barré syndrome in an ICU, laying completely paralyzed, had a blood count of 8. And the doctor came in the morning and said, we're going to transfuse today. And I looked at him and said, you're going to what? We're going to transfuse. Now, I'm smart enough to understand there is no reason for that transfusion. My daughter's on a ventilator. She's not expending any energy. She didn't need a blood transfusion, but I could ask. We didn't do the transfusion. But I know the reason that the transfusion recommendation was made. It was habit, because generally when you see a hemoglobin of less than 8, people are pretty symptomatic, and there's a guideline that says you probably ought to think about transfusing when you go less than 8. But there are times when you shouldn't do that. So there's a lot of habit, and a simple thing is to try to get physicians in particular to understand, if you think you pretty well know what's going on, you probably don't need to go to a lot of additional testing. And the easy question that we need to try, from my perspective, to train physicians is, if it's not going to change what I'm going to do, there's probably not any reason to do the test, whether it's a simple blood test or a complex angiogram. If it's not going to change what you're going to do, then don't do it. Leave it for later when you think you really need the results to guide you.
Doctor, just as you're responding to Senator Nino's question, why do you think that doctors, physicians, don't explain to patients what the costs of things might be? For example, if I have a problem with my car and I go to the repair shop and I say, I want my car fixed, and they say, okay, I don't say just fix it and I'll come back tomorrow and pick it up. Typically what you do is you say, well, tell me what's wrong and then tell me what the costs are to do these things and call me back and then I'll tell you whether you should go ahead and do it. And that's pretty much the general practice, not only with auto repair but with lots and lots of things that people do. But I've had similar experiences, Senator Nino, and I'm sure other people have, where, and I've even asked doctors on occasion, and they'll say, I don't know what the cost is. I don't know what the price is. Why is that? Why don't we have a culture? And I appreciate your point about we're all creatures of habit, and habits aren't necessarily bad. They can save us useless time trying to rethink things. But why don't we have the practice or the habit of saying, well, look, here's the things we could do. Here's a range of things. Here's the prices to do this. My recommendation as a professional is this. You're the customer. You're the patient. What do you think? Why isn't that the practice?
Well, I think we actually can do more about helping patients make logical decisions using scientific evidence about what should be done. But the question about the cost, when the doctor says, I don't know, the doctor doesn't know. And the reason is because the financing and payment for medical care has become so complicated that you don't know. I can send a patient downstairs and to the business office and give them a price list, but it may not be what their cost is because we don't know what their coverage is. I have the same problem every day that I prescribe medicines in the office, and I have to tell patients that there may be some better option. Medicines are expensive these days, and so when I sit down, I have a patient that's taking 6 or 8, or about 10% of my patients are taking 12, and you look at them, and some of them are costing $6 a day, you start thinking there should be some better options. But the difficulty is that I can't tell what those options are because I don't know what the coverage is, and the patients usually don't know either. So some of them can give me a card saying, I'm covered by Aetna or I'm covered by Blue Cross. And I can then try, I don't get paid for this, but I can then try to log on to the website of that plan and figure out what's in the formulary and then try to figure out what the best option would be for the patient. But I can't tell them what it's going to cost them. I don't know what their copay would be. I don't know what their out-of-pocket would be. And I can't then give them a comparative option of, if I'm treating your blood pressure, it would cost you $30 a month for this medicine, lisinopril, and it would cost you $3 a month for this medicine, hydrochlorothiazide. It may be that it would cost them the same. It may be that one would be the less expensive one would turn out to be more expensive based on the plan. That's why I was saying earlier, when we think about options in Minnesota, if we could create a single statewide approach to doing these sorts of things, where then you could be more consistent about demonstrating the cost for patients, we might be able to make much better decisions in that regard.
Thank you for your comment, Doctor. I appreciate that. I think that is one of the things that we wrestle with, is how to get better price information into the marketplace, how to create a marketplace, actually, and use prices as a way to evaluate quality and cost, or the value to the customer or the patient to do that. I'm reminded in your comments of I was in a conversation recently with some people who do health insurance, and for a lot of people who are doing HSA structures or paying out-of-pocket for ongoing expenses, and they get into the practice of doing price shopping and how difficult it is. And just an example that sort of surprised me is that if you have a prescription and you go to the corner drugstore and you say, I want this prescription, what's it going to cost me? Apparently, they can't tell you until they actually process the prescription. And so you can have them process the prescription, and then they'll report the price. And then if you want to compare that, you got to take your prescription to some other pharmacy and have them process the prescription, which means getting a doctor to cooperate with you to give you another prescription to go to another pharmacy and get them to fill it, and then you can compare. But a very, very cumbersome process just to find out, what is the price to me if I want to pay out of pocket for this medication?
Right. The other problem is that there may be some other options. So if you got the prescription, so say your blood pressure needs to be treated, I could give the prescription to you for lisinopril, and you could take it to the pharmacy and figure out what that prescription costs. But I have some different options to give you besides lisinopril. I could give you valsartan, or I could give you hydrochlorothiazide, or I could give you even another drug in the same class as lisinopril. But you couldn't get the pharmacist to tell you that price very readily until he probably processed several prescriptions. And I actually sometimes will write down on a piece of paper for the patient some options. So if you take this to the pharmacist and you think it's too expensive to buy, ask the pharmacist if these others would be an option. And if he thinks it is, you have him fax back to me a request for a new prescription. But if I don't take the time to do that, the patient doesn't have any clue about what the options are, and the pharmacist, who's also busy, may not take the time to discuss that with the patient. That's why I'm saying if we can create a sort of a single statewide approach that would make the options clear and, in fact, make it evident that everybody in the state knows what the best prescription is, then use that information and drive then prescribing to the best option at the lowest price.
Thank you. Doctor, I appreciate your being here, and I do want to move on. We do have another presentation we want to hear, but I want to thank you for being here today, and I also want to thank you and your institution, the Mayo Clinic, hospitals and clinics. We who live in Minnesota really appreciate and understand the value that you bring to our state, not only economically, but also just as a contributor to our reputation as a leader in healthcare and in medical care in this state, around the country, around the world. So we're grateful for the work that you do and others do down at the Mayo, and we appreciate your willingness to come here and help us and look forward to working with you as we go forward.
Well, again, I appreciate the opportunity and hope I can be of service to you and your colleagues.
Thank you, Doctor. I'd like to, at this time, invite Scott Leitz, I believe. I hope I've got your name correct, from the Department of Human Services. Members, we are have asked for a brief presentation, a briefing, I guess, if you will, on the implementation of the medical assistance expansion that was recently enacted by Governor Dayton. I appreciate your being here. And could you introduce yourself for the record?
Of course, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Leitz, and I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Human Services.
Thank you. Mr. Leitz, before you begin, I just wanted to sort of set the stage for you, and part of my interest, and there may be other interests among committee members, but prior to the start of the year, back in November and December, in conversations I had with the previous commissioner, and I understand that there was discussion about early enrollment with then-Governor-elect Dayton, and there was a timetable established for if we elected to do this, that it would take a certain amount of time. And in fact, the information I saw and the timeline I saw that was, I understood, put together by the department showed that there was a number of steps and a number of things that had to happen, and that extended the implementation out until October. And as I recall, that was information that was communicated to then-Governor-elect Dayton, which I understand he was not necessarily pleased to receive, but that was what it was. And then subsequent to that, recently there was the announcement that this would be done by March 1st. And so my curiosity is to know what happened to that plan, and why was the plan originally suggesting that it would be October before we could implement this expansion, and now apparently we can do it by March. And if you could help us to understand that, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to do that along the way. If it's useful for the committee, I'll give a brief overview of what the expansion is, and then discuss some of those issues. Mr. Chair, the medical assistance program, Medicaid program, has been in place as a federal and state partnership since 1965. It covers about half of the enrollment in Minnesota is children, but it also covers, as Dr. Wood's slides pointed out, a lot of disabled and elderly individuals. It's a joint partnership, meaning the funding for the program is shared between the state and the federal government. Under the federal health reform law, states will be required to have eligibility by the year 2014 up to 133% of federal poverty for single adults or childless adults. The bill also allowed for states, at their option, to expand Medicaid more rapidly for those populations up to that level at a state option. The 2010 legislature authorized the governor to allow an expansion for childless adults up to 75% of poverty. And Governor Dayton signed an executive order on January 5th to do that expansion under the Medicaid program for implementation by March 1st. Under the expansion, about 95,000 adults without children in the home, without children under age 21 in the home, are estimated to be covered by MA. Their incomes must be below 75% of poverty, which is a little over $8,000 per year, or a little less than $700 a month. Approximately 32,000 of those individuals are people who would have previously been enrolled in the state-funded general assistance medical care program, which was delivered since June through the Coordinated Care Delivery System, or CCDS as it's known. About 51,000 of those individuals are Minnesota Care enrollees, and about 12,000 are not currently in a state health program. Now, the plans for implementation of this program have to be approved by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. We are actively working currently with CMS to receive that approval. The state cost of the MA early expansion is equivalent to the current state cost of providing coverage to GAMC and Minnesota Care enrollees who shift into MA. Starting March 1st, new applicants who are eligible for MA can enroll. They can enroll as they always would through county and tribal agencies. Current GAMC enrollees will not have to take any actions. They can continue to go to their health providers for services, and they will be automatically enrolled and receive MA benefits starting March 1st. The GAMC program will end on March 1st, and the CCDS system will also be terminated at that date. Minnesota Care enrollees who meet the MA expansion criteria can continue going to their health plan providers. They will be manually converted to MA by either state or county staff. They will receive their MA benefits with retroactive effective date of March 1st. We'll be doing a manual conversion of this. This relates to sort of the way the state's somewhat antiquated Medicaid systems for eligibility and payment are set up, and it will require some manual conversion of those Minnesota Care enrollees into the Medicaid data system. DHS will provide services for new applicants and GAMC enrollees on a fee-for-service basis for about 45 days for an initial period until they are enrolled in a managed care plan. It's a period over which they would ordinarily, if you're enrolling in MA, a period of time is given for you to select the plan. We pay fee-for-service rates during that time period until they selected a managed care plan to go into. During this process, we've been working closely in partnership with county and tribal workers, providers, community groups, and other stakeholders to make this as seamless as possible and for both the individuals who will be affected by the enrollment, as well as the groups that will be doing the enrollment, the providers who will be seeing them, the health plans that will be enrolling them, and so forth. In terms, Mr. Chair, of the question that you posed at the outset relating to timelines, the original timeline that was given, I think, back several months ago was an October timeline. That in Governor Dayton's executive order, it's a March 1st timeline. The department is accomplishing that via we have done some reprioritization within the department with regards to projects that we'll be working on. That is not uncommon within the agency, that we have a number, as you can imagine, of law changes that we have to accomplish every year that frequently require reprioritization within the department. We certainly strive to achieve our timelines on every project that we've been given, but this was a top priority of the incoming administration, and so therefore had a prioritization along that vein. In addition, the manual conversion of the Minnesota Care enrollees, which make up the bulk of the enrollment here, will be done over about a six-month period. We'll finish that up in, I believe, August of this year. That also will be occurring over a series of months. So those individuals will be able to be enrolled in Medicaid, but the conversion will be occurring over that time period, which takes some of the immediate pressure off of meeting all the enrollment pieces for every single enrollee by March 1st.
Thank you, Mr. Leitz. A couple of questions. There were some costs associated with implementation that I understand we have anticipated in the forecast. And I'm not sure exactly what the assumptions that were made when those costs were put into the forecast, but does this accelerated implementation have any bearing on that cost assumption? Is it going to increase costs, or is this going to affect the cost estimates in any way?
Mr. Chair, the accelerated timeline for this does not affect the costs.
Thank you. Mr. Leitz, the other question I had was, you mentioned in your presentation that this plan needs to have the approval of the federal CMS. And what is the timeline for that approval? And is it true that before we can begin to implement, we need to gain the approval of that federal organization before we can begin implementation?
Mr. Chair, I'll give you my week and a half at the agency understanding of that question. I believe the answer is that we anticipate receiving approval by March 1st. We've been actively working with CMS. They've been very cooperative and collaborative in helping us meet. They understand the timeline that we're on to meet this. My understanding is that we will work to receive that approval. We anticipate receiving that approval by March 1st.
So, Mr. Leitz, if I'm understanding you, if you do not receive that approval, then you will not be implementing on March 1st. Is that correct?
from the whispers I've received, Mr. Chair, my understanding is that we would still be able to implement because the approval would be of a state plan amendment goes back to the first of the quarter. Was it the first day of the quarter it was received?
So, Mr. Leitz, the way the federal expectation is that you don't need to actually have the approval in hand, you just need to have it sometime in the quarter that you begin implementation. Is that essentially what you're saying?
I believe that was my understanding.
Well, Mr. Leitz, another question that has arisen in the last couple of days, given the recent Florida federal court decision about the constitutionality of this entire law, and I believe that that makes it somewhat uncertain what the future of this law at the federal level will be. Does that present some hazard to us if we go forward with a early implementation and discover 2 months from now or 6 months from now that this whole law is invalid? What does that mean for us? Does that put us at risk in terms of assuming burdens that would not be paid for by the federal government? Is there some cause for caution here rather than full speed ahead?
Mr. Chair, you know, as to the constitutionality questions, those are obviously issues that will be worked out in a separate venue. We're proceeding with the expectation that the implementationists will continue to move forward. So, you know, it is our goal to get that implementation done by March 1st. And that is our expectation and what we're operating on right now.
Thank you. Senator Berglund, do you have a question?
Yeah, just on this point, Mr. Chairman, even this judge ruled the Medicaid portions of the law were constitutional, and this would be a Medicaid portion of the law.
And Senator Berglund, I'm certainly not an attorney, but
not either.
I don't know if anybody here in the room
puts us at an advantage.
Senator Newman, maybe. But as I understand the decision, that his comment was that the entire law was invalidated by his finding of unconstitutionality because of the non-severability of the law. But I don't want to engage in the. I'm just raising the question here as a practical matter that if this law fails the constitutional test, I'm concerned a little bit about the uncertainty that may create as we are beginning to implement something under the auspices of a federal law, federal structure that may not be valid. But I appreciate you're not the one making that decision, Mr. Leitz. Other questions? Senator Benson.
Just one clarifying question. It was my understanding that a lot of the counties wouldn't be ready until August 1st, October 1st. Now we're hearing manual process is going to happen, and we're going to catch up by October 1st. Can you assure us that you won't be coming back for one dime for this manual process?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, we will not be seeking any additional funding for those processes.
Senator Sharon.
That used to be not a question, just a comment. What I am encouraged by is that what I'm hearing is the capacity within the administrative branch and the departments that serve the administration have been able to figure out a way to accomplish things more quickly and more efficiently. I do think that that's an important part of cost savings as well, that we move things and not delay things in the departments, and that's an administrative it's an indication to me that this administration is going to demand the performances out of the administrative branch.
Mr. Leitz, I have another question. In your earlier comments, you mentioned that on March 1st, we would see the discontinuation of the GAMC and also this CCDS structure that was part of the law that was passed a year or so ago. And I have had conversations with hospitals that have implemented that, some of the representatives of those hospitals, and we even had them come to the committee and talk a little bit about their experience. Seemed to me that there were a lot of things that they learned from that, some of them very positive, and they have expressed to me at least interest in continuing to work on those kinds of things. The discontinuation of this program, to me, presents some threat to that reform initiative, and what is going to happen to that structure and the incentives that are currently in place to operate under those structures as this is eliminated March 1st? Does that just go away then?
Senator Hand, the It's an excellent question. And you're absolutely right. There were a number of learnings from the CCDS experience that really, I think, providers learned a great deal about how best to coordinate care for some pretty high-need populations, some pretty difficult-to-manage populations. And many of those were very, very positive experiences from a learnings perspective. We're extremely interested in capturing those learnings as moving forward. The legislature last year, in fact, sort of, I think, in a sense, sort of saw this coming and authorized the department in a couple of areas to do an RFP to the market, to providers in the state, to create what are called accountable care organizations, which share many of the same attributes in many ways about coordinating care across populations that the CCDS system, I think, in some ways forced in many provider systems. We intend to move forward with implementing that or with letting that RFP because we want to create opportunities for providers who did learn things and want to continue to do that care coordination to provide them opportunities to do that within the Medicaid program. You also authorized some pilots for Ramsey County and Hennepin County that really build off the CCDS system, and we're looking for ways to actively work with them to implement those as well. So we absolutely agree that there were some excellent learnings under CCDS. We don't want to lose those at all. In fact, we want to build off some of those learnings.
And Mr. Lights, in your comments, you mentioned that the elimination of the GMC and the CCDS would result in fee-for-service payments for those patients, but that seems to be a little bit in conflict with my understanding of what was happening under the CCDS. So how is that going to be?
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, there will be a very brief period of time, about 45 days, until enrollees in the Medicaid expansion program enroll in their managed care plans and their health plans. During that period of time, when they're choosing their plan, they may also be receiving services. Since they're not in a health plan, we pay fee for service for the services they receive during that time period. Once they're in a health plan, they're enrolled and receive services under their plan. Moving forward, what we'll be looking at both for those enrollees in managed care plans as well as in pilots such as been authorized for Hennepin County, which is more of a direct contracting type of a pilot where a health plan isn't necessarily involved, we will be actively pursuing arrangements similar to or have elements that are similar to what was in the CCDS in the sense of care coordination, providers having incentives to manage care for those populations and having a financial incentive if they're able to lower utilization and increase quality outcomes for folks. So really want to make a distinction between how we pay for care at a high level versus how we're hoping to organize care better as CCDS helped force in some situations.
Senator Berkley.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Lights, is there any chance that the demonstrations for Regions and Hennepin Medical Center could begin on March 1st? I know the fiscal note never anticipated that, but I don't think the law necessarily creates any restrictions on when it would start. And, of course, we didn't know when we passed that law that people would be as good at getting new delivery structures in place as they have been.
Mr. Lice.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, we're very anxious to get rolling with the pilots as soon as possible. The largest challenge that we have, and it's in the language in the bill, is that in order to implement those, we need to receive federal approval to do so. The way the language on the Hennepin County Ramsey Regions pilots is structured, the federal approval piece will simply be something that we'll have to go to CMS with when we have a plan for them to do those pilots. We have had some discussions with Hennepin about moving forward on those pilots. We are working with them to help develop what the actual pilot will look like. And once we have that, then we'll have a plan that we can go to CMS to receive approval to work towards receiving approval on. But I do have to mention that, you know, I know a number of you have been around long enough to know that the approval process, while I think speedier than it has been in the past, is still something that is, from a time perspective, just something we need to keep in mind.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Lights, it can't just be done as a state plan amendment. It has to be like a waiver approval.
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, that's something that we're looking at right now. Without getting too deep into the details, the risk-sharing arrangement that the Hennepin and Ramsey pilots have is more of a pure capitation approach, which typically would involve a waiver process as opposed to a state plan amendment, but we're looking for ways to try to be as creative around that as we possibly can.
Thank you.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back to the question on CMS approval. What would happen if approval wasn't received until after March and into April, into the second quarter of the year?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nino, since we started the approval process in the first quarter, if it did go beyond, it would go back to, since we submitted in the first quarter, it would be eligible in the first quarter. The submission went in the first quarter, so therefore, even if approval were to go beyond that, my understanding is, and we'll double-check this and get back to you to ensure this, is that it would go back to that first quarter.
Thank you. Thank you, members. And Mr. Leitz, we appreciate your coming here and on relatively short notice to give us an update. We may need to invite you back for further discussion as this goes forward, but we appreciate your willingness to be here, and thank you for your
help. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And members, thank you, and with this, we're adjourned.